everyone. I'm Dr. Christian Heim.
And I'm Dr. Caroline Heim.
And I'm a clinical psychiatrist.
And I'm an associate professor. Welcome to episode 9 of our Resilient Relationships Talk Show.
Episode 9, Caroline, what are we talking about?
Today's topic is day-to-day romance and resilience.
Romance and resilience, day-to-day. Okay, that sounds like a fun topic, but I got to say, it could be a frightening topic for some people as well.
A frightening topic? Why frightening?
Well, it puts pressure on people. Okay, so I've worked with couples where somebody says, oh, I'm not romantic on a day-to-day basis. And so although this is a lot of fun to talk about, it can be frightening for some people. So I'm hoping that we'll get to dispel some myths through some of the science, which we'll be bringing you, the stories from our couples. And, I'll have a few tips along the way.
Fantastic. As usual, we will have got some evidence to back this up a little bit. So the evidence today comes from our survey of 1,112 coupled individuals from 52 different countries who have been married for 40 plus years. And what was really interesting for this question is we asked them, in a survey, what do you do daily to, keep the resilience, to keep the romance in your relationship, to keep that relationship together? And, what are the things that have really helped you? And it's some of that seem like little things, but they're long-term things that have made their relationship resilient. So in this talk, we'll be talking about, we're actually going to just generally talk about day-to-day romance and resilience. And then we'll go in and we'll talk about what some of the couples told us works for them.
Yeah, and interspersed with that, I'll actually see what we've known through the scientific literature over the last 20 or 30 years. Where should we go from there, Caroline?
Well, you actually said this, that you were talking about that it's perhaps a little bit of a myth or what?
No, it's not so much a myth, but okay, so we're here on a Resilient Relationship podcast, and it can be a lot of fun talking about things like romance and what we should do on a day-to-day basis. But real-life couples, who I've seen in couples therapy, can feel pressured. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. You've got to be more romantic. Well, I'm not that romantic. And the science actually tells us that it's not the romance things that make couples resilient. We'll get into that. We'll get into what it actually is. But the answer is a few things. One, it's not as frightening. You're actually allowed to be yourself. In fact, it's actually better if you are yourself. And ultimately, the answer is just in doing things together. Just be together. Spend time together.
Great. So that's it. Right? Yeah, so it is. I think it does put pressure on people because I felt that pressure too. What are those little things? And you hear about it on the internet, you see it in social media. Oh, and do this and do that. And, you've got to, even for the younger people, there's so much pressure to have the perfect, proposal for marriage and set it up perfectly. And people are seeing stories of people having the ultimate life, social media.
So here's the problem. The problem is the stories, okay, that we get on social media and on the internet. They're romanticized. They're actually put together so that people will click on them rather than give you the good information. So what I want to do is give a little bit of a framework so we know how to think about this. Because just as a reminder, we know what the top three things are that our couples told us that build relationship resilience over their 40 plus years of being together. And that was commitment, that was altruism, and that was shared values. So they're all sort of broad brushstroke topics. But the question that I want to explore is how those things are actually then expressed on a day-to-day basis. How do you do it? How do you show somebody that you are committed to them, that you're being altruistic, that you share their values on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, okay. So it's not flowers every day. It's not this every day. It's not that every day. It's not all of those dating things.
Well, I'm actually glad that you brought up flowers because one of the most amazing findings that we have in our relationship survey is a lot of women don't like flowers.
Oh my goodness, so many of them didn't like flowers. Actually, I would say, yeah, a good 15-20% said, I don't like flowers.
Yeah, I thought it was actually higher than that, but, you know, it's significant, and that's the whole thing. And the other thing is, they don't like chocolate either, all right?
No, they didn't like flowers and chocolate. Actually, some of the couples, quite a few of the women said, look, I don't like flowers, I just have to see them die, and that doesn't make me feel good about our relationship. And I don't like chocolates because it just makes me put on weight. You know, buy me a good magazine, even someone said, rather than chocolates, if you want to get me something physical, you know, something actual, if you want to get me something material. But there are so many other things that you can do that you know, express love on a day-to-day basis, okay, that are more important than
things. Yeah. And I suppose talking about flowers and chocolates is what dispels the myth, okay? Because flowers and chocolates is one of those dating things, whereas after 5, 10, 15 years of marriage, you don't want to be dating. You want to be at a point where you actually know each other, where you actually spend time together and you feel comfortable with each other. Dating is not feeling comfortable with each other. So there's something that you move into after 5 or 10 years or however, or that you grow into gradually, that expresses things day to day that is not flowers and chocolates. It's not I love you on a day-to-day basis. It's something deeper than that. It's something that shows your commitment, your altruism, your shared values. And let's get into some of that. What did the couples tell us?
Okay, all right. So there were actually 18 different responses to this.
Okay.
Are we going to go through them all?
We'll see how we go.
Okay, we'll see how we go. I can start off with the top three because they're quite significant, and maybe we'll get into the others later because these were definitely the biggest percentages. So maybe I'll just read out the top three and then we'll go through each of them. Okay. So things that couples did on a day-to-day basis to bring more romance and resilience into their lives or to keep their relationship romantic and resilient. Number one, by far, was to talk with each other and to listen.
Sorry, what did you say?
You weren't listening.
Okay. Yeah. So if you don't listen, okay, that means that you are not responsive. You're not available. And that already gives that feeling that you're not committed to the person, because that idea of being available and responsive is the way that you show that you're committed to that person. That's really good. Really simple. Talking and listening.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of quotes here that I'd like to say from the couples on that. I mean, we did talk a lot about listening last episode, but this is a lovely quote. This is actually from Susan and Bruce from Zimbabwe, who have been married for 49 years. And this is what they said in a day-to-day. We listen to each other. We value each other's opinion. We listen to each other's point of view.
Now, I've got to say, what I love is even when you read that out, you go into this quiet, peaceful mode that only Caroline can do. And it's just so beautiful, because in there, although you were talking with a listening tone. And it sort of showed that attentiveness, that focus that says, I am there for you.
Yeah, and it's really hard, as we said last week, as we said last episode, to put your own needs aside and really listen to someone. And it is a gift that you give them. And as you said, as I slowed down, it's a slowing down of life to actually listen.
Yeah, and I suppose that's one of the keys, that it takes time. It takes time to talk. It takes time to listen. You actually need to be together and spend life together at a pace where you feel like you're there for each other to actually have this resilient romance sort of thing happening.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, the next one, I want to give another quote for talking and listening, and this is from Peter and Elizabeth from Australia, who have been married for 60 years. This is about talking and communication, because this couple actually, boy, they'd been through an incredible amount. They had pressure on their marriage from an outside person, and they'd lived in many different countries and they'd had a hard time. Okay, so Peter said, you have to keep talking. Communication is the most important thing. If you stop talking, then you're setting yourself up to go in different directions. We talk and talk and talk.
So I love the way that you set that up, aside from that beautiful voice that you use. You talked about how Peter and Elizabeth had threats to their marriage from an outside person, okay? But being able to talk means that that bridge of communication between just the two of them means that they were able to not only share information, but also share their emotions and share their relationship so that they could ward off this threat by staying in communication.
Yeah, really, really important. And actually, one of the other survey responders said that if you don't communicate, you know, you really are setting yourself up to go in different directions.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a theme.
Yeah, it is definitely a theme. So it's obviously part of the glue that keeps your relationship together. But they'd actually said the same thing, hadn't they?
That's right. They said exactly the same thing. And I suppose what I want to do is relate back the day-to-day talking is a way of sharing values, because that's how you share values. Secondly, it's altruistic, because you need to take time out to actually talk together. And it shows that commitment, because this is the person that you share so many words with because you're committed to them in the long term.
But there's not everyone are talkers. Some, you know, just they have a quiet understanding and they like to just sit in the room together and just know each other.
It's not as though you have to talk. Like, you took us into a situation where people weren't talking perhaps, but they're still spending time together. And a lot of couples have shared that as they go on in their relationship journey, the need to share things becomes less. And just the beautiful feeling of spending time together perhaps becomes more important.
Yeah, more important, yeah. Okay, should we go on to number two?
Number two
is touch.
Touch.
So this was, you know, hugs and kisses and whatever touch is. Do not tickle me, Christian. You know I'm very ticklish. Not online, anyway.
All right, touch.
Okay, touch. This is Pat and Jim. Now, Pat and Jim, they had a story. So Jim was a Vietnam vet, and he had severe PTSD from his involvement in Vietnam. They'd been together for 45 years, and this was the couple that said, you know, the Vietnam War hasn't ever stopped in our house, which was so hard. They were carrying so much. But for them, and particularly for Pat, touch was really important. This is something she said that kept her going all the way through the difficult times too, and kept their relationship resilient. Hug each other every opportunity you have, she said.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, so there was couples, obviously, that used touch just in passing, or there were plenty of couples that said kiss before you go to bed at night and kiss when you get up in the morning. So there's some couples that are kissy couples, and there are some couples that are huggy couples.
And again, I suppose I want to take the pressure off by saying there are some couples that are not kissy couples, and there are some couples that are not huggy couples. And couples work that out themselves, because that's where the pressure comes, where people feel that they need to be who they're not to fulfill an ideal that's out there. Whereas couples, you'll work it out yourself. Your level of talking, your level of intimacy, your level of touching, your level of spending time together. And whatever that is, it's okay.
Whatever that is, it's okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So touch became important also with couples that were, it became an issue, let's say, with couples where touch and hugging and what we call in Australia, cuddling, so cuddles, that wasn't modeled to them at all. They didn't come from a family that had much of that. And one person in the couple wanted that and the other person didn't, or one person taught the other one how to have more cuddles and touches, or they just found a nice equilibrium between the two.
Yeah, and I suppose, Caroline, what you've said there is couples work it out themselves.
Yeah.
And over time, and this is called acculturation, acculturation, and all of our brains do it. Our brain will adjust how we behave for the person that we're closest to. And that's a wonderful thing, because it actually means that one person becomes more like the other person, and that person becomes more like that their partner as well. So you find not so much a middle ground, but you forge what you share together. And that's beautiful, because that's the uniqueness of a relationship.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so number two is touch.
Number two is touch. Let's go on to number three.
Number three is acts of service.
Acts of service.
Yeah.
So doing stuff for each other.
Doing stuff for each other.
Take the garbage out, dear.
Yeah, well, that was one of the big ones.
All right, that's a big one.
Doing something to help the other one with chores. Okay, that was, and something unexpected, something that wasn't in, oh, well, I do this, and, you know, there was big talks about division of chores, of course, and there is in amongst couples often, but they would do something to surprise the other. Oh, I got home and the house is clean, or this is when it's to do with chores.
Oh, I like that so much, because you're talking about the element of surprise.
Yeah.
So it's not so much the doing of a chore, it's that element of surprise.
Yeah.
And what that does is release dopamine in your partner's brain, and it makes for a bit of excitement. And okay, movies won't talk about the excitement of doing a chore for somebody. They'll talk about the excitement of a helicopter ride or a big holiday or a big surprise, because in the movies, that's what we romanticize. But on a day-to-day basis, that element of surprise can actually keep the romance flowing. And I do mean the physical intimacy romance and the emotional romance, as well as just that joy of being alive.
Yeah, and I think the surprise comes in when it's something that is really out of character for one of the couple, something that's really out of couple for one of the spouses, you know. Oh, they wouldn't normally do that, or they extend themselves to go that extra mile.
So that idea of extending yourself, because we all get into patterns, we all get into habits, and we all get into routines, which is fine. The brain loves familiarity, but that's got to be coupled, if I may say, with the opposite, which is novelty, doing something different, having that element of surprise.
Yeah.
So, look, since we've talked, have you got some couples quotes about that?
No, I don't have any. I just have a list of a few of the other things that they do for each other, but keep on watching.
Give us that list, because I want to go into the brain and talk about what those top three things actually do.
Okay, all right.
But let's complete this.
Okay, so for acts of service, there were, you know, apart from chores, which was the majority of things, listening was one of the acts of service that they talked about.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there were things that were very individual for each couple, obviously, because you get to know each other and you know what is an act of service for the other. But I wanted to say this one, because this is quite outstanding. One spouse would often take difficult phone calls for the other.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, so, oh, I can't talk to my mother at this point. Can you talk to her? But it wasn't even like that. It was more like, I'll take this call. Someone's getting anxious about a call or having to make a call, and the spouse would then make it for them.
And that also brings up the issue of how technology changes how relationships get done, because before it used to be one telephone per household, and now more and more people have their own mobile phone. So it's like that act of service can't be done. It's like we call people individually. You don't call a household, which means that we can actually corner each other in today's world a whole lot more, with the opportunity of doing something for your spouse here less. Like, I don't carry your mobile phone, so I can't take a call, let's say, from one of your siblings when you don't particularly want to take that call. They know it's got to be to you.
Yeah, it's so individualized now, isn't it?
It is, and
there's something lost with that too.
Yeah.
Some of the other acts of service were when to do with different milestones and different, you know, seasons in the couple's lives. So obviously, when they were first married, they were talking a lot about, you know, when they were both working, that one of the spouses would have a meal waiting for them, a surprise meal, or gift them with a holiday. Look, I booked a holiday away. And then when the children came along, acts of service became obviously, oh, well, I'll get up for the child tonight, don't you worry. Those plenty of acts of service when both of the spouses are absolutely exhausted.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's other acts of service that come when sickness comes and such. So there's different seasons in life where there's where the relationship evolves and the acts of service evolve with that.
Yeah, and there's another one that comes to mind that you actually like talking about a lot, is the act of service in preserving somebody else's sleep or private time.
Yes, that was something that is not talked about enough.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sacrificing, yeah, it's a sacrifice in a way, you know, saying, okay, I'm just going to lie here and let them sleep because I know that if I get up, it's going to disturb them, or just letting them sleep. There's, you know, couples go at different paces sometimes, and that need to jump out of bed or then and get on with the day, whereas the other one is more of a, you know, a paced down person. But getting to know your couple and doing that as an act of service by preserving their sleep.
And also just knowing when your partner needs some time to themselves, undisturbed,
so true.
And perhaps even taking their mobile phone and say, we'll either switch this off or I will take the calls, but you spend some time for yourself, you know, and that's not together time, that's alone time, but preserving that is an act of service.
Yeah, true, and knowing that spouse needs that time on their
own. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, not everybody does.
No, that's true.
Right? But that's where knowing and understanding and accepting who your spouse is actually an act of service.
Yeah.
And it always involves a little bit of sacrifice.
Yeah.
Doing something for somebody else.
True.
All right, so I'm going to take us inside the brain. Is that okay?
Great.
Okay, so the top three were?
The top three were talk and listen,
number one.
Number two was touch.
Yeah.
And number three was acts of service.
Yeah. So what this does inside the brain is basically make you feel special, make you feel valued. And so it involves a circuit called the social brain, which involves always my favorite part of the brain called the anterior cingulate gyrus, where your brain feels that it is in resonance and in relationship with other brains, particularly with your spouse. Okay, so when you talk and when you listen and when you share that time with somebody, it is actually warm feelings that are evoked by the release of a chemical called oxytocin, which we know by now mediates those feelings of love and trust, but it also calms down another part of your brain called the amygdala, which is the stress response in you. And it's like this chemical oxytocin is like a little rush of love that says, chill, settle down, it's okay. You can actually be calmer because there is somebody around taking the time to listen, to talk, and basically who loves you.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the information that gets exchanged, actually that's always secondary, it's just the process of exchanging information. Same with the touch. The touch is something that the brain registers and goes, oh my gosh, what's that? It's that feeling of empathy that gets aroused inside you, as well as just the pressure of the touch. But it's a knowing touch. It's saying, no, that's a touch of my love partner.
Mm.
And that touch will say certain things. That touch can say, I need you at the moment. That touch can say, I am here for you at the moment. That touch can say, I love you. That touch may sometimes say, we've got something that we need to talk about.
That touch can say, it's okay.
That's
okay.
Right. And that touch itself can be calming. Just like the oxytocin can calm the amygdala, a touch on somebody's shoulder can calm their emotions. The element of surprise, however, is a bit of a arousal wake up for your brain to say life is fun too, life is adventure, and this works on the dopamine system. It motivates you, it makes you feel alive when somebody goes out of their routine to say, hey, I'm going to do something special for you, this will feel good, and here's a surprise. I've done something that you didn't expect me to. I've done something for your pleasure, done something for your mealtime, done something to just make you say, hey, I'm here. We're sharing a life that's exciting as well as routine together. And all of that gets expressed in the brain, felt in the limbic system, and known in the frontal lobe that this is the special person that you are committed to and share your values with.
So does oxytocin and dopamine then rise as more of these sort of acts of service and touch and talking and listening happen as the couples get closer together?
So as the couples get closer together, that feeling of being closer together, we know is mediated by oxytocin in particular. Mm. And look, there's a whole soup of brain chemicals, of which we only know a few, that work together. So dopamine works together with oxytocin, works together with serotonin, works together with endorphins, can even work together with adrenaline to make a relationship feel... relationship feel exciting at times. You want that excitement, but you don't want it all the time. Mm. Otherwise, there wouldn't be that peace, that rest. And it's a fluctuation of all these hormones and chemicals that keep a relationship fresh and exciting, but also familiar and calming.
Ah, oh, there's that word familiarity again. I know you, and that's familiarity, yeah.
And it's more than knowing somebody. It's actually understanding them and accepting them. We know our enemies, okay, but that doesn't mean we want to be around them too much. But being able to accept, you accept me and me accept you, to enter that comfort zone of being together, that actually feels good. You create a time and space for togetherness.
Wonderful. Should we find out some more things that create a time and space for togetherness through the rest of them?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, let's look through the list because there's some really interesting ones here. And again, it's all very individual for each couple. And everyone finds their own together language for what builds resilience for them each day. So we had talk listen number one, touch number two, acts of service number three. They really were overwhelming but in their percentages. But then we went to number four, which was laughing and joking together.
I don't believe that. Yeah, no, okay, so there's something very special with humour.
Mm.
And this is worth actually knowing because a lot of psychiatry is based on the premise of trying to get people's emotions and thoughts heading in the same direction. A lot of inner turmoil and conflict happens when we think one thing but we feel another, or we feel that we have to say or do something that's contrary to what we actually believe. So that's called cognitive dissonance. The nice thing about humour is it brings together your thinking and your feeling. So if somebody tells you a joke, you feel the humour, but you have to think about it to get there. And that's why humour in particular is really good in uniting your thoughts and your feelings. And in a relationship, articulating feelings is not often a good way of doing it, because you can't go around saying, "I love you" all day long. But when you laugh together, again, you get that feeling of togetherness, which is not only oxytocin and the pleasure of a joke through dopamine, but beta endorphins, which is that feeling of being together. When you laugh together or you cry together, you feel like you're together. And that's a wonderful feeling.
It is a wonderful feeling. That's another little brain chemical you've thrown in there with beta endorphins.
Yeah, I know. You... A lot of brain chemicals these days, yeah.
No, this is... I want to put in a little bit of a caveat in this one also, though, because some of the couples that I interviewed, when I said, you know, how important is laughter and humour, and they said, no, we don't do that, you know? So There are some couples that have a different kind of a communication language, and laughter and humour is not part of that. Again, to do with modelling. And, I mean, you know, in my situation, I didn't grow up with much modelling of laughter or humour either, whereas you did.
Yeah.
And so I got to learn to laugh a little bit more. And it was such a joyous thing to laugh. I do a little bit of clowning, so I learned to laugh through clowning too. But it was such a release of those brain chemicals that it was contagious and I wanted more of it. So there is a lot more laughter and humour in our marriage now, which is great.
Yeah, there is. And that's a wonderful journey that we've gone on, and a wonderful journey that you've personally gone on. But again, I don't want to pressure people to think that they have to have the romance, they have to have the laughter. It's like the chocolates and the flowers, all right? It seems to be one of those things that in social media, okay, so if you're advertising for somebody, you want somebody with a good sense of humor. And, you know, sort of it's like everybody out on those dating sites has got a good sense of humor. Well, you know what? Some people don't have a good sense of humor. And that's okay. Some people learn to have a good sense of humor, but some people don't learn to have a good sense of humor. And that's okay. What's actually important is the togetherness of being with somebody who understands and accepts what your level of sense of humor is and who you are as a person.
Yeah, very important to point out.
Yeah, so... All right, so we're looking at another balance, and it's another big thing in psychiatry which puts pressure on relationships. And the balance is that we all want to be attached to somebody and accepted, but we also want to be our authentic selves. And to be, let's say, with a group of friends or even to be with a love partner, you have to give up a bit of who you are, but you don't want to do too much, otherwise you will think you're being fake. And yet to be yourself, you don't want to give up being with people either. You want to find that balance. And to make that balance, the idea is to be authentically yourself. Like, I'm really being me. But to be understood and accepted for being you by at least one other person, so that you feel accepted and attached. And that's the beautiful sweet spot, in a way, that we're looking for, and that's available in a couple's relationship.
Okay, great. Authenticity, very important.
Authenticity, but attachment as well.
Yeah. All right, let's look at number five. This was pretty predictable. It's surprising it came up as number five, which was saying, I love you.
Predictable and surprising.
No, it's surprising that it came up at number five. Not
well, where did you expect it to be?
Well, up near the top.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, I'm sure that if you ask younger couples, which we haven't yet, which we may, what were some of those little acts of service and not... What were some of those things that, you know, you do on a daily basis, and they say, saying I love you, you know, and all of that. And it's a little bit cliche, I guess, too.
Yes and no, because what you've touched upon is, again, that that to be in a resilient relationship is a process. It's a process that happens over time, which means that the relationship changes over time. So being able to say that I love you early in a relationship, you can't say it too early in a relationship, otherwise it doesn't come across as genuine. And they're big words to say when you first say it, and then you want to keep hearing it. But then as a relationship progresses, you actually don't have to keep saying it. And some people think it's actually detrimental to keep saying it.
Yes.
Because it becomes understood. It becomes known. It doesn't have to be brought to the surface all the time. But even that's different. There are some couples that just love hearing, I love you, absolutely every day.
That's right. And I do think it's important to talk about the detrimental or the I love you that can be said as a need. I love you, it's more of, comes from more of an insecurity, actually, and I have seen this in couples.
Yes. So couples who say I love you often, or let's say people who say I love you often, often have had trauma in their background.
Yes.
And it's that, well, I don't want to lose you. That's what they actually mean when they say I love you. I don't want to lose you. And in a way, you'd like to be able to get past that in your relationship. But again, it's an individual relationship journey that's being authentic as well as growing. And there's nothing wrong with saying that I love you, but it's this pressure to say I love you, where somebody is demanding in a relationship, or what I think is worse, that we have an idea that this is what a good relationship does, and there are plenty of messages out there in the internet and social media that says unless somebody does that, they're not being good in a relationship. And that's a pity, because we start to caricature and limit what a good relationship is. And there are so many different relationships out there. I mean, we're talking about 18 things that people do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Right? That just shows a variety, right?
It does. And I think that's really important. There's so many times when the couples have said to me too, I don't need to tell him or her that I love them. I show them through my acts of service, through my touch, through listening. So they've got other ways to say I love you.
Yeah, they do. But I've got to put in another balance here.
You're always balancing it, but it is important.
Yeah. And I suppose this is something that psychiatrists do. We can't let that to be an excuse for never saying I love
you. Yes, and that's an excuse for someone.
Well, yeah, because, you know, there's a lot of people who say, well, yeah, she knows that I love her. I don't need to say it. But you know what? Just occasionally she'd like to hear it. And even because it's difficult for you to say, that's why she likes to hear it, right?
That's right.
And she appreciates that the love is in the trying, that you have actually gone out of your comfort zone and surprised her or him by saying, you know what? I love you.
Mm.
And if that becomes that surprise element then you've got that dopamine release and becomes precious. It's something that you share only with this person.
That's so true. I guess it comes back to loving the other person the way that they want to be loved. It comes back to loving the other person the way that they need to be loved.
So the way that they want and need to be loved is actually very important, and this harks back to the altruism needed in a relationship. Your job is to love me the way that I need to be loved, and my job is to love you the way that you need to be loved.
Mm.
There are going to be some clashes in there,
mm.
and there's going to be some things that need to be worked through, but that's part of the process.
Most definitely. Okay. It's been a long time on that one. Let's move to the next one, which is a pretty basic one, enjoying meals and coffee together. That's just part of their daily relationship resilience.
And I wouldn't put that one down either, because
I'm not putting it down.
Well, you said it's a pretty basic one. You
know? Well, it's one that's taken. Let's say it's taken for granted more than anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is taken for granted. But what the science is showing, and this is where I've done a little bit of research before this episode to see what keeps people resilient on a day-to-day basis. It is actually these little things of spending time together. In fact, the most important one is actually having a meal together.
Mm.
In fact, there was one paper from 2019 that basically said if you could spend just one more meal per week together, your chances of saying that you are in an extremely happy relationship go up significantly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's just a little project for anybody there who feels that their day-to-day is not quite going as well as they could. If you're spending 5 meals a week together, try to make it 6.
If you're spending no meals together, try to make it 1.
That's right. Because you have to be together to talk together. You have to be together to touch. You have to be together to do acts of service together. And an act of service can just be, how do you want your tea? I'll get the tea this afternoon.
Mm. And some of the couples obviously talked about making meals together too, which is a fun thing to do, making it and sharing together. But it is so important during that sharing time that you're communicating too. So it's so hard in this world because of technology. There's always a tendency to have the phones at the table and all of that. But you know, mealtime slows you down. It's a beautiful timelessness that you can have where you, okay, we've set aside this hour and we're going to make the meal together and we're going to sit down and have it together, or we're just going to sit down and have some takeaway, whatever it happens to be.
And this is really important if you're a couple, let's say, in your 40s or your 50s and you're actually producing a lot, you're working hard, and you want to make the most of every minute. What that does is put a lot of stress on the relationship if you're trying to get everything out of every minute and you're just kind of fitting in meals.
Mm.
Because the body is designed, its nervous system is designed to either be in fight or flight mode, which is part of the working time, getting out there and being productive, or being in rest and digest mode. Where if you imagine you're on the Italian Riviera with some of your best friends overlooking a beautiful ocean, and you have beautiful wine and wonderful meal in front of you, and you're taking time for your food. If you're able to take time for your meal, your whole body's stress response gets a lot weaker and you get more resilient in yourself as a body and as a person, but your relationship becomes more resilient simply because you're taking time and spending it with the person that you love.
Yeah, it's a wonderful and fun thing to do too.
It is, it's a fun thing to do. Just as long as I'm doing the cooking, yeah?
Oh, yes, at the moment. Thank you. Yeah. Terrible cook anyway.
All right.
I really am. I am a good baker, but I'm a terrible cook. We know that. We have established it after 33 years. We do know that.
All right. While we're on the science of how to spend time together.
Yes.
The very first thing is the meals.
Yes.
But the second thing is quite surprising.
What?
I find that the second... the science says that the second most important thing to do in spending time together as a couple is driving.
Driving?
Driving.
Okay.
Just going for drives. Just spending time together, going places and coming home again. Because if that time in the car is increased, it means it gives you more opportunity just to talk about things, just to listen about things, just to share a few things. And it's just a simple act of being together for a longer period of time. Let's say if you drive to work together, that means that for a good half an hour, you're together. Whereas if you have a long commute together, apart, it means that you're separate for longer.
Mm.
And that's the difficulty of modern day living for a lot of middle couples who are in their 40s and 50s, working hard, that they just don't get to spend that time together. So if you can commute together, if you can drive in together, or if you can go for Sunday afternoon drives together... it all means time together so that you can talk and listen.
I don't think anyone does Sunday afternoon drives together anymore, do they, Christian? Is that so 1980s?
It may be 1980s, but it's still one of those things that the evidence shows is good for talking and listening and touching.
I'm just having a go at you because I do know young couples that pack a picnic and will go out for a drive on a Sunday or on a weekend day or even a weekday when they've got a free day and spend that time together, which is lovely to see.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. So eating together, driving together too. Next is shared interests. So, yeah, when you've got shared interests, a lot of the couples have separate interests, but their shared interests together and doing that, that built resilience because they would prioritize that more over their own individual interests, and that built the more of the resilience. Next is being kind and caring.
Being kind and caring.
Yeah, that's a lovely one. Complimenting, appreciating, and thanking. So that was sort of all put together. So actually complimenting the other person, appreciating what they did, gratitude, saying thank you, all of those niceties do make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And number 10, so we're up to about 10, is little surprises. Little surprises. That
yep.
ties in a little bit with acts of service.
Yeah.
And I'm going to run through the last ones very quickly, and then I'll just say them, and if there's anything we want to pull out.
Yeah, because there's already sort of a pattern emerging, right? So surprises.
Yeah.
But also those acts of service with kindness and being there for somebody, you know, mm. is another category that's kind of running through.
It is.
What actually happens on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, so for the last 8 were just being there. So some of the couples said just being there. That was, you know, being there and being available, just being there, being in the same room, being together instead of living separate lives. Another one was trying not to argue. So actually making an effort not to argue. These obviously couples that argue quite a bit and that's a problem. Arguing is a problem in their relationship. Other couples, next on the list was walking together, going for walks together. Another one was an interesting one, actually, and quite a few couples said this, don't control. So not controlling the other person, actually making an effort not to control the other person when you're a controlling person.
Yeah, I suppose that's an act of service in a way.
Yeah, it is, yeah. That's true. Playing games and dancing together, that was another one. Praying together for people that had a belief, some sort of a religious belief. Being patient with each other. And the last one was, in contradiction to another one, arguing.
Arguing.
Yes, arguing was a thing that they did on a day-to-day basis, this couple said, that made their relationship resilient.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's good. So horses for courses, different strokes for different folks, different things work for different people, and you can choose and pick. But in a way, you kind of know what may work for you. So if there's a need that's not being fulfilled, it's actually worth talking about that.
Very important. I thought that, I mean, obviously everyone comes up with their own things that build their resilience, and they work it out as a couple, but I like the one just being there, because a lot of the couples did talk about, you know, going for drives and not saying anything, like not having to communicate, just being there, or just sitting in a room reading together, or going for a walk together and not even talking, but just being there. Being there also meant being present and available to the other person, or being in relationship with the other person. There is that, you know, that connection that the couples that I saw when I interviewed them, you know, the ones that I interviewed that had been married for 40 plus years, they had a connection there that was a being there. They were very much a unit.
I suppose we've got to talk about one that's absent, because for some reason none of our couples seem to have physical intimacy or use sex as a way of connecting on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I guess it came under touch.
Under touch?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there were a couple that talked about sex, but it wasn't a dominant.
So perhaps rather than just touch and hugs, it's forms of and displays of affection.
That's right. That would be it, yes. That's probably a better way of putting it.
Yeah, perhaps another thing is, we've been talking about couples who've been together more than 40 years in this, and so it could become something that's taken for granted, or it's something that perhaps they didn't want to talk about, or it's changed in their relationship because early on in the relationship it tends to be more important than later on in the relationship, because people end up in a pattern of whatever their physical intimacy is for them.
I think you've touched on all those things that would make them not talk about it. Particularly, I think there is a little bit of a generational thing coming on here with the, we don't talk about sex that much, you know, so we don't talk about sex that much in public, and I'm not going to talk about it in this interview because it'll go into your book. So
so maybe it was a private thing, so it didn't come up
it
as much.
It was their world.
Because on the one hand, sex almost defines a married relationship, because it's something that you do with this person that you don't do with anybody else, and yet we don't talk about it terribly much. And the other thing is, there can, of course, become too much pressure on sex, which becomes part of that romance myth as well, that we're trying to dispel here, that whatever works for your relationship works for your relationship. And as I've seen in couples that I've worked with in therapy, you don't want to be under pressure to be somebody who you're not. Mm. You want it all to be able to come spontaneously, however you show your affection and your resilience on a day-to-day basis.
Yep, that's right. Do you have any tips or anything that we'd like to finish off? We've got a bit of time here at the end.
A few things to say is to be authentic, to be yourself. But again, you've got to balance that. Gosh, this is one of balances, isn't it?
It is.
You've got to balance that with your need to extend yourself for your love partner. Because if your love partner has some needs, then they'll want those fulfilled. And you're the person to fulfill them. Not absolutely everything. There are one person cannot fulfill everything in another person. But if they are love needs, if they are acts of service, if they are kisses and hugs and touches and intimacies, if it's being there for somebody, if it's talking and listening, do your best to fulfill the other person's needs, because the love is in the trying.
Yeah, and I want to go back to that first one, actually, talking and listening, because I know that is a form of intimacy too, isn't it? Particularly for women, it is. For me, it is anyway.
Yeah, so we'll be able to do a podcast on intimacy, because you're right, listening is a form of intimacy, and there are different forms of intimacy, particularly emotional intimacy and physical intimacy, but intimacy per se is just that feeling of being close. And this is why listening is such a big part of intimacy, because when you're listening to somebody, they will actually reveal parts of themselves that they don't reveal to anybody else. So listening to that becomes a privilege, it becomes a gift, it becomes a sacrifice, but it also becomes something that only the two of you share. And so it comes back to sharing, being together, and having the time and space on even a daily basis to let your relationship unfold.
I think that's a nice place to end, actually. So I'll just give a little bit of a summary of the top, say, five of those special day-to-day acts of resilience and romance in these couples that have, you know, made it up till 40-plus years. Number one is talk and listen. Number two is touch. Number three is acts of service. Number four is laugh and joke together. And number five is say, I love you.
Yeah, and I'm quickly going to say that even just hearing those things, there'll be a lot of people out there that go, oh my gosh, we don't have any of that going on. And we're going through a rough patch at the moment. And my message for today is that the love is in the trying. For these top things, if you can just try to talk and listen more, express what needs to be expressed, look for a few more touches, but actually talk about what your relationship needs, because when you're able to get back into that space that you probably had earlier in your relationship, when both of you were special to each other, and re-enter that, because it hasn't gone. It's probably buried under a lot of social problems, financial problems, children problems, education problems, who knows what, but your relationship is your greatest asset. Keep it resilient on a day-to-day basis.
You said it. You said our little catchphrase there. Your relationship's our greatest asset. So we will finish off with that. We hope that you will join us again in another month's time for another Resilient Relationships talk show. But until then, please take care, stay strong, and we look forward to your company next time.
Bye for now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Resilient Relationships Talk Show, our very first episode.
My name is Dr. Christian Heim.
And my name is Dr. Caroline Heim.
And I'm from Sydney, Australia.
And I'm from Sydney, Australia.
That's good. I'm a clinical psychiatrist.
And I'm an associate professor at a university.
But in a former life, I was a classical musician.
And in a former life, I was a New York actor.
And together, we have been married for over 30 years, but for this talk show, we're bringing together our expertise, our experiences, and our research to bring you a show so that your relationship can stay together longer and stronger.
That's right. That's what it's all about. And it's actually based on a study. All our research that we'll be sharing on this talk show is based on a study that we did that we've just finished, that is the largest cross-sectional study on long-term relationships to date.
To date, yes. And look, this study and this research, which we've been engaged in for quite some years now, has spawned books and journal articles and lectures, and now this talk show, to bring it out in the world, because this world needs to know how to keep relationships together.
That's right. So who's our audience, though, for this?
Who is our audience? Well, our audience at the moment is whoever is out there. Thank you for joining
us.
Yes,
thank you. It's you.
It's you. It definitely is you. So primarily, this is for people who choose to be in a long-term relationship, are finding that, you know, being in a long-term relationship is difficult. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yes.
You know, yes, you have. Okay, good. So it's to give techniques for people who are in a long-term relationship, but it's also for people who have been in a long-term relationship for a long time, and they just want to keep it going. It's also for people who are thinking of being in a long-term relationship, are looking for a long-term relationship. And Caroline, they've got to know what they're in for, because it takes effort before the reward. But the good news is, if you put in the effort, you get the reward.
Well, as some of our couples said that we interviewed for our study, it's damn hard work.
Yes.
But there's gold at the end. Well, actually, there's gold
all the way through.
So the gold comes with the effort.
Yeah.
But we're in a society that lets you think that you can have things easily, that you can have things without effort. And that just is not true. So we've got to get through some of the lies of our society to get to the truth and the evidence of what it takes to keep a relationship together.
That's right. And it is actually all in the evidence. That's the most important thing. So each week we're going to be giving you a little bit of science. We're going to be giving you a bit of application of the science. And then we are also going to be giving you some stories. So do you want to talk to the science a little bit, Christian?
Okay. So as a loose structure, we're going to look at science because as researchers, we are scientists.
Yeah.
Okay, now doctors aren't quite scientists, but what we do is based on science, and you in the humanities also need science as a body of knowledge to keep things together. So where do we get to know the science? We get to know the science mainly through journals, where we get to publish what we have found in our research, but we will also be looking at other journal articles of what other people have researched and what their findings are. So the other thing about the science is it's our best shot of knowing what reality actually is. So we're going to put a lot of emphasis on the science, okay? Because science is also something that everybody in the world can agree on. Whatever our beliefs are, whatever our diversity is, science says, no, this is the closest that we can get to objectivity. So another thing about the science is I like to take you inside the brain because in the last 25 years in particular, we have found out a lot about how the brain works, and a lot of the brain is still a mystery, but there's a lot that we know, and it is just fascinating to see what happens when two people come into relationship and live together day in, day out. What happens is they affect each other's brains quite deeply and change each other's brains and mold so that the brains grow closer together if the relationship is working well. So I like to describe how that actually happens and what we know of the science of what's going on in the brain in two people who are in close relationship.
And this comes from your psychiatric background, studying the brain, and it's actually really exciting stuff to actually see how the brain works and also how that works for couples to keep couples together. And the facts are out there. The facts are out there in the journal articles and even in the science in the brain.
In fact, this is one of the exciting things about being alive in human history right now. We have so much information, so much good information that we do have answers out there. The thing is that perhaps we've got too much information and we've got to wade through what is good information and what is not so good information,
yeah.
Which is why we've got this emphasis on science, because the information is the best that we can actually have. So yeah. That's the science.
That's the science. Okay, then. That's great, but we do need to apply it because they're facts. Yes, it's very interesting and everything, but how do we apply it? That's why we've got the application section.
So every week we'll be looking at applying the science and, you know, it's not easy. This is actually where we all fall down. This is what you need to do, but you sort of go, well, how is that going to show up in my life? Okay, so let's take something like commitment, which we know is scientifically is something that is needed for a good long-term relationship. Mm. How do I get that working in my life? Because we know that commitment is not just a one day when you said, I do, and that's enough. So what do I got to do? Have I got to wake up every morning and say that I'm committed? No. But we've got to look at how people actually show their commitment to show their love to their partner. And this is the application, getting it actually working in your life. And this is where we've got to interpret the science and we've got to modify it so that it works for different people in different situations so that they can get this thing happening, which is making relationships longer and stronger. And that's what this talk show is all about.
Yeah, and you talked about that word commitment.
I did.
Ouch. This is a big talking point and we will be coming back to it a lot because, the media's got a lot to say about it. We've got a lot to say about it. Our results have a lot to say about it. We've got some great stories about commitment and what it means and what it can mean from you and some really great techniques even on how to, apply some of the science to your life.
Well, okay, so that's like the third part of what we'll be doing in these talk shows. We'll be looking at techniques and we'll be looking at
stories.
Because the brain actually works in stories, and I'm going back to the science here, but stories are becoming very important because stories unite us as human beings.
Yeah.
They also separate us as individuals, and there's a big tension between what individuals want and their journeys and what the meta story, so in other words, the whole cultural story of our society is. And we have to be a part of that, because if we lose that, then we can actually lose civilization. So there's a tension between the individual and society, and it's united in stories, because in a very deep sense, a person's individual story reflects the whole story of humankind. So,
wow. I'm sorry, you throw these things out there,
I do,
and I'm just going to have to get you to explain that a little bit more.
Okay, so in our society today, we talk a lot about diversity and the importance of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're emphasizing how different we are as people. But the question is, how different are we really? Because we all are born, we have to develop as children, then we have to contribute as adults, and we have to reproduce for the whole of the human race to keep going, and then we all die. And in that, there's a common story. There's a story that is common to us all.